At one point, I needed a PDP-11 cross-assembler that ran on the incompatible time-sharing system on the PDP-10. Well, I found one that ran on DEX time-sharing system, which they later called TOPS-10, and I used to call BOTS-10 because I felt that a name that contained praise was not appropriate for that system. So I got it, and it was free software. It had been written by somebody at Digital, apparently. And so I ported it to the incompatible time-sharing system, and I added a bunch more macro features, and we used it. And then somebody at BBNN wanted to run it on 10X. So he ported it and added more macro features, and then he got back in touch with me, and we merged it with conditionals so that we maintained a common source. And this seemed like the natural way for, you know, people developing knowledge to work together. In those days, of course, there wasn't a free software movement. It was just how we lived. And in fact, I believe free software goes back to the very dawn of computing. But through the 1970s, this started to change. First, computer companies like Digital started making proprietary software. There was a computer lab at Harvard where they had a policy of always making all of the system source code available for the users to read. They couldn't keep it on disk because the disk was too small, but at least they had a listing printed out so that, because they said, we're an educational institution, part where people come here to learn about computer systems. Well, part of what they should be able to learn about is how the operating system works. So they said that all the programs that were in the operating system, all the installed system programs, they insisted had to have a listing there. Well, at one point, somebody offered them, quote, free, unquote, a copy of a proprietary utility. And they said, no, we won't install it here. We refuse to install it because if we can't put a copy of the source code on display for people to study, then we shouldn't have it. And I was really impressed by somebody who cared more about doing the right thing than about what was convenient in a technical sense. You know, engineers tend to be constantly thinking about what's the most convenient, how can I get this done fastest, and in the process of doing that, they pay less and less attention to the question of what's right and wrong, what makes a good community. So they made a special example by not being like the rest. So, in the early 1980s, the free software community really fell apart because even people at universities stopped participating. For what really killed it was the Scribe text formatter, because the guy who wrote that, instead of sharing it with a community in the usual way, sold it to a company. Well, he now admits that the main result of that was to cause it not to be used very much. But at the time, I suppose he didn't know that. And, well, he was nice to us. He gave MIT a, quote, free, unquote, copy. That is, we didn't have to pay for it the way everyone else did, that we could run, but no source code. And then I remember one day somebody reported that it wouldn't handle his file, and one of the hackers started debugging it, which wasn't easy given the fact that it didn't have symbols, and eventually figured out what the problem was. It had a deliberate bug that would make it cease to work after a certain date. It took him hours to figure that out, and he was very mad. Well, the problem is that we had a community where people had voluntarily helped each other, and when people saw that one person was being uncooperative for money and getting rewarded for being an asshole, other people started to feel, well, I'd like some money too. Maybe I should be uncooperative. Society collapsed. Essentially, I lived through society turning into a jungle where nobody will help each other anymore. I had never used Unix, but I decided that this provided a good model to give us a reasonably good chance of producing a system that people could use. And what's more, by making the system compatible with Unix, it would mean that there was a large community of people who would be in a position to switch fairly easily. Whereas if I simply looked at all the various operating systems I had worked on and designed my idea of an ideal, clean, beautiful operating system, it would be incompatible, and maybe nobody would ever use it except a handful of hackers. So I decided to make the system compatible with Unix. And besides, Unix had some good ideas in it, things like pipes and redirection, and shell programming was nice. So, the simplicity of the file system naming was nice. So there were also bad things about it, some of which we're stuck with for compatibility's sake, like the fact that when you start writing an existing file, it truncates the file instead of superseding it the way previous operating systems had done. You know, on good operating systems, you start to write a file named foo, there's already a file named foo. Well, your version of foo gets written and written and written, and eventually you say, okay, I'm finished, and then instantaneously the new copy replaces the old copy, and anybody reading foo at any time sees a valid version, either the old one or a new one. Well, I mean, you can do this with renaming, but it's somewhat kludgy. You've got to pick a name for it to have in the meantime, and it's ugly. Anyway, and the directory has to give you write permission in order for you to do that, it's impossible. So it's somewhat of a mess, but it can't be fixed because of compatibility. Too many things would break if we tried to change that. Well, anyway, so Unix had good ideas and bad ideas, but overall it was good enough. So I decided we would make a Unix-compatible operating system, and then the next thing I needed was a name. Well, there is a hacker tradition that when you are writing something compatible with an existing thing, you can give it a name that is a recursive acronym which says, this thing is not the other. So, for example, there was the editor Tico, and there were many implementations of Tico, more or less compatible, and they were all called Tico, typically. But then somebody had the brilliant idea of calling it Tint, which stood for Tint is not Tico. And then there was Emacs, and there were many implementations of Emacs-like editors, and many of them were just called something or other Emacs, but one was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs, and then there was Sign, for Sign is not Emacs. And then on the Lisp machine, there was Ina, for Ina is not Emacs. And then when Ina was almost completely rewritten, but not totally, the new version was called Zwei, for Zwei was Ina initially. So, of course, I needed a recursive acronym. And I looked around, and the word GNU is one of the funniest words in the English language because, you know, English has crazy spelling rules, but a silent G at the beginning of a word is weird even for English. And so people make lots of jokes and funny songs about that word. So once I realized I could use that word, GNU's not Unix, well, I couldn't possibly consider anything else. So I had a funny name. Every hacker needs to have a funny name for a program. And I had the overall design. It was possible to start working. So I wrote up a sort of design proposal, and I started sending it to companies, saying to them with this logic, you might expect you or your customers to be spending perhaps millions of dollars a year on Unix license costs. If you invest a tiny fraction of that in this project, then if we succeed, you can save that money. So even if you think there's only a small chance we will succeed, it's a worthwhile investment for insurance purposes. It's still a worthwhile bet. So I gave that to executives at some companies, and sometimes the executives thought it was an interesting idea, but there was never any follow-up. So I said, well, I guess there won't be funding. I'll just start coding. So that's what I did. I resigned my job at MIT, but I was surprised that the head of the lab suggested that I should keep my key and keep using their computers. So I didn't have to go find computers to use. And for the first few years, I was using an MIT computer. Well, at the time, the first thing to do was look around and see what existing software there was, because putting together a free operating system doesn't mean you have to write every component from scratch. In fact, it's such a big job that you want to find as many existing free components as you can just to make the rest of the job feasible. So one thing I thought I might be able to find was a compiler. I'd heard of something called the Free University Compiler Kit, or VUC, because this comes from the Netherlands. So I contacted the author and said, I'm developing a free Unix-like operating system. We need a C compiler. Can you contribute this? And he sent me a rather nasty response. He said, the university is free, but the compiler isn't. Why don't you forget that silly idea? I'd like to have some utilities to distribute with the compiler to encourage more people to buy it. Why don't you supply me with some utilities, and I'll give you a share of the profits? Now, if he had just said no, I mean, if that's not too unusual, but I mean, for somebody to just try to enlist me in some disgusting scheme, well, I told him, well, the first thing I'm going to work on is a free compiler, thank you. So I got my hands on a compiler called Pastel, which had been written at Lawrence Livermore Lab as part of a supercomputer project, but it was a compiler that was designed to handle multiple languages and multiple machines. But the only language it handled so far was the Pastel language, which is Pascal extended in every way anyone could ever imagine. They said that the name Pastel meant off-color Pascal. So my first step was to implement a C front end, and I did. And then I decided to port it from the VAX to the 68000. So I wrote the code, and then I started trying to bootstrap the thing onto the 68000. And then I pretty quickly came to a problem I couldn't solve. Namely, the 68000 Unix system I had available would only give you 64K of stack, maximum. But this compiler expected to use megabytes of stack. And not only that, it had been written for a supercomputer project in which they figured, so what if we use 64 megabytes of memory for compiling everything? So the way it was written, it read your whole source file into code, parsing it into syntax trees, and then it converted each function into intermediate code, and then it output the whole thing as binary or a listing, and it never freed any storage in the whole process. So this was a pretty serious problem, and I wasn't sure what to do. So I put it aside, and I wrote GNU Emacs. GNU Emacs was the first piece of GNU software that was actually useful. And it was the beginning of 1984 when I started the project. I started GNU Emacs in September, and the next year it was becoming useful. So I distributed it by anonymous FTP. But in addition, there were people not on the network who wanted to use it, who asked how could they get copies. So I decided that I would offer to mail them copies for $150. Now, at this point, a lot of people think that there's a contradiction, and they say to me, what do you mean it's free software if it costs $150? Well, the English word free has two meanings. One meaning refers to price, and one meaning refers to freedom. There's a word that specifically refers to zero price, and that's gratis. But there's no word that specifically and only refers to something that has freedom. So there's no better way I can say it. But free software is a matter of freedom, not price. So you should think of free speech, not free beer. So free software tends to mean that many people will redistribute it. So there's a pretty good chance you can get a copy at no charge or at very little charge, but that's not what it's all about. The goal is not to have this person pay less money to this person. I'm not on a crusade that programmers should not get money. I'm a programmer. I like having money. All else being equal, I would rather have more money. But that's not the only thing that's important. I won't get more money by undermining cooperation in society and putting chains onto other people. But if I can make money without doing that, then why shouldn't I? So it's not the selling of a copy for money that's the evil. The evil in ordinary proprietary software is something different. It's putting the chains onto you after you have a copy. That's what's wrong. And I found out, I realized how wrong this was when I had a particular experience. During the 1970s, we used some printers at the AI lab that had been given to us by Xerox. First, we used something we called the xerographic printer. It wasn't a laser printer. It was something more old-fashioned than that. It had a one-dimensional CRT in it. So it could print, you know, it printed a matrix of bits, sort of like a laser printer, but it was sort of wavy and not such good resolution. And it was very slow, and it got jams very often. And the software was free software. We had the source code, and we put in features to make the printer work well for us. For example, it took a long time to get to your printout, but we added a feature that when your printout was finished, it would display a message on your screen immediately saying, your file such and such has been printed. So you wouldn't have to wait any extra time guessing when it was done. And when the paper jammed or it ran out of something, it would display a message on the screen of everybody who was waiting for a printout saying, the printer is broken, you better come fix it. Well, of course, these people would immediately head for the printer and fix it. They didn't want to have to wait. So the result was the printer would get fixed very quickly. Although it was unreliable, its duty cycle was almost 100%. I think I'm the person who added that last feature. I'm proud of it. It's working around the deficient hardware. Anyway, then Xerox gave us a laser printer. That was in the late 70s, the first time we'd ever seen a laser printer. It was this tall and this big. It was essentially a fast Xerox machine that had been fitted with the laser equipment. And it was driven by a special spooling computer, which ran non-free proprietary software. So when you would print a file, it would immediately tell you your file has been spooled. And then you'd have to guess how long to wait. So you'd maybe guess an hour. So you'd go back, or you'd guess, you just realize, I'm going to have to wait a while. So you go back to work. An hour later, you realize, hey, maybe it's long enough. I should go see if my printout is out. So you go there and you see the papers, it's been jammed for half an hour. So you fix it and go back to work. And maybe half an hour again, you realize, hey, I should go back to the printer. Maybe now it's come out. You go back there, you see it printed 200 pages of other people's stuff and jammed again. So then you decide, I'm going to stay here and fix it over and over until my printout is out. Now, we were certainly competent to add the features that we needed. But Xerox wouldn't let us add it because they wouldn't give us the source code. We were prisoners of our software. So this illustrates one of the freedoms that the term free software means, the freedom to help yourself by changing the software to do what you need. Well, one day I heard that there was a person at Carnegie Mellon who had a copy of the source code. So the next time I was in Pittsburgh, I went to his office and said, hey, could I have a copy? Which was what we always did. But he said, no, I promised I wouldn't give you a copy. I was so stunned, I didn't know what to say. I just walked out. But he didn't just do that to me. He did that to you, too. He promised not to give you a copy. He did that to you, too. He promised not to give you a copy. In fact, he had done that, I would expect, to everybody in this room, just about everybody in the entire world. He had essentially betrayed the entire world to get something for himself. He had signed a non-disclosure agreement. This was my first experience with a non-disclosure agreement. I was the victim. And that was actually very good for me, to be the victim. So the first time someone asked me to sign one of those things, I said, no, it's unethical for me to sign this. If I sign this, I will be betraying other people. I will be promising not to help other people who I should be willing and able to help as a decent citizen of society. And this points out the second of the freedoms that free software refers to, and that is the freedom to help your neighbor. Because if you're forbidden to help your neighbor, there is no society. For computer users, the most fundamental way that you help your neighbor is by sharing information from your computer to your neighbor's computer. If we accept a system of society, whether it's imposed by law or whether it's so-called voluntary, but the cost of not participating is tremendous, so you can't. Either way, we have accepted an ugly way of life. The third level of freedom that the term free software refers to is the freedom to help build your community. The way you help build your community is by making improvements in a free program and then releasing an improved version that other people can then use and further add to. So these are the three freedoms that the term free software refers to. If something doesn't include these freedoms for everyone, then it is not free software. So, I was selling tapes for $150. But if you bought a tape, the software would come to you with all of these three freedoms, just as it would if you copied it from the net. So every user was free to cooperate and to improve things. Now, because I had seen the disintegration of the old software sharing community, I felt that the new one ought to have more of a defense against being abused. And I also was fully aware that there were people who would simply love to take a free program I wrote, make a proprietary modified version, and then distribute that as an executable that you can't understand with no source code, and say that people are forbidden to share it. And I realized that if they did this, I would be playing catch-up. I would be in the position of trying to redo the improvements they had made, or else people, many users who are concerned only with convenience and performance might switch to the proprietary version, and I would have failed to achieve what I was trying to achieve. So I wanted to make sure that there was a reason why, at least in some ways, if you participate in the community, you must contribute your efforts to the community. And this was the reason for developing a general public license. At first, I released Emacs with a specific Emacs general public license. Later on, though, gradually redesigning this, I turned it into something that was subroutinized so that it could be invoked from any program. See, of course, legal language is really a kind of computer program almost. It's a program in legal ball, we could call it. So the GNU General Public License is a subroutine in legal ball designed that you, so that you can easily call it from any program you release to so that you not only give each user, each person who receives it directly from you, the three levels of freedom, but you in fact guarantee these freedoms to each person who gets a copy. No middleman can pass along the software, stripping away the freedom so that subsequent users are using a non-free program. If you look around at other free software, such as X Windows, you can see that this is actually very common if it is not prohibited. If nothing is done to guarantee that every user must receive these freedoms, people will make proprietary versions, and often, in the case of X Windows, you can see that most users get the proprietary versions. there are all these, so many companies that do, or did at least, distribute Unix systems with proprietary versions of X Windows, and in many cases, the free version wouldn't even run on that computer, so there were people who couldn't use a free X Windows. All they got was a proprietary program with no more freedom than any other proprietary program. The general public license is what makes sure that can't happen to GNU software. Now, I should point out that there are several different categories of software based on their distribution terms. There's free software, there's GPL-covered software. A program can't, X Windows, for example, it's not GPL-covered, but it is, if we get the free version, at least that is free software. So we can use it in a free operating system, and we do use it in GNU systems. It's somewhat of a shame that it is not copylefted, but fundamentally, at least, it is a contribution to the free software community, and that's the most important thing. So, the other thing that I found GPL does is that when people who work for a company, maybe it's a software company, make an improvement in a GNU program, the first thing the guy's boss is going to think is, hey, maybe we can hoard this, and maybe we can make our own improved proprietary version. Ah. But then, of course, the programmer himself wants to contribute the change. So the GPL gives the programmer an excuse to say, sorry, boss, but we're not actually allowed to do that. Here are the distribution terms, and they say that it would be copyright infringement if we did that. And the boss says, oh, well, okay, you can contribute it. I'll sign off on it. And this happens from time to time. And as a result, we get to use the contributions of programmers who work for companies that make proprietary software. In some cases, companies actually fund the development of extensions, sometimes very important extensions. For example, the C++ compiler and the Objective-C compiler front ends were developed by organizations that normally make proprietary software. And in the case of the Objective-C front end, I had a meeting with Steve Jobs where he said to me, well, what would you think if we distributed the Objective-C files as .o files and said to the user, thank you, could you just put it down, yeah. Or it'll fall off on that. Just, so on the floor is fine. Thank you.
It's free.
Oh. But free in the sense of freedom or free in the sense of price? Are we free to copy this tea? Does anyone here have a tea copier? See, this is something people say to me, people who are thinking in a very simplistic way. They say to me, well, if software should be free, why shouldn't gasoline or tea be free? And I say, well, you know, someday when there's a gasoline copier or a tea copier or a car copier or whatever, then that will become a significant social question. But at the moment, since those things don't exist, the question doesn't really arise. What it means is that when people talk about intellectual property, they're talking about something which is very different from physical object property. But then because they use the same word property to describe them both, then they try to tell you that you should treat them as if they were the same. And that leads to intellectual error. So always be on guard against that. What is this? Oh, well, I guess not too bad. Better than coughing. Yeah, the transporter is malfunctioning today. Good thing I didn't go through it. Anyway, so then the word copyleft was suggested by a friend who... I hope this wasn't demagnetizing my credit cards. Well, yeah, I guess it might be. I'll have to find out later. Anyway, I don't have any in here. So, so he wrote me a letter where the envelope was covered by all sorts of weird things, and one of them was copy left, all rights reversed. And then I thought about it and decided I'd prefer copy left, all wrongs reversed. Because I'm a person who very much thinks about justice and injustice. So I realized that copy left could describe this practice. But the copy left is a general idea. It's the idea of guaranteeing everyone certain freedoms by legally forbidding anyone to take them away from anybody else. The GNU GPL is one specific implementation of copy left. And there can be others. In fact, the GNU Library Public License is a different implementation of copyleft.